Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. We are in Zechariah chapter 14. We're going to go through verses 6 through 21. In my mind, we're going to finish the book of Zechariah tonight and go back to Ezra next week because we're in the middle of Ezra. Remember, in 536 B.C., they started to rebuild the temple. The altar was set. You know, they came back in 539, 538. 536, opposition arose. They sent a letter, over to Persia. The Persians sent a letter back and kind of verified the fact that they could be opposed and the Samaritans opposed them. And so they just went into this stall of not doing anything until 520. And 520, we'll look at it maybe tonight right at the end. 520, two prophets arose, Haggai and Zechariah, and began to talk to the people like, what are you doing? And they, well, it's not the Lord's will. It's not time. We can't do it. They say, yet, you know, you're building your houses. And then by 516, the temple was completed. And Zechariah and Haggai are prophesying 520, 518. That's when it's kind of dated. And so we stopped and took a break to read those two prophets that motivated the people that had come back. So we're right in here, 520, 519, 518. Now we're going to go back to 516 right here. Next week, I hope, and pick up what the work of these two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, had done. Now we talk about, you know, Jeremiah, 40-year ministry, no one paid attention. Isaiah, he ends up getting killed by the king, according to Jewish tradition, and as we look at it in the book of Hebrews, and other prophets who didn't seem to, you know, Amos, Micah, guys that didn't have an impact on their culture, their generation, where Haggai and Zechariah, the people listened, responded, and finished the temple. So we do have two examples of two prophets that made a difference. Now, by the time we get to chapter 14 of Zechariah, we're way off subject of rebuilding the temple. But what these last few chapters have been is the eschatological vision of what's going to take place. If they get this temple built, then great things are happening. Of course, they, in their understanding, they're building the temple for the days of glory. And then it comes the Greeks, and they have that situation. Then eventually the persecution by the Maccabees have to fight. And then the Lord comes, Jesus comes, and all along, is this it? Is this it? Is this it? Well, here we are, you know, 2023, when we're still waiting for these verses to be fulfilled. But yet, just like these verses affected the people of this time, to that they're you're doing something that's going to have a big impact on world history. Well, these verses haven't been fulfilled yet, and yet today we're still waiting for them and contributing. Of course, we're not building this temple or participating in this temple, but we are building the body of Christ. We are doing the things to keep the vision of the future going that God is ultimately going to bring about in His own power, in His own time. So, Zechariah chapter 14, I'll read through, starting in chapter 14, verse 1, a day of the Lord is coming. Again, this day is a period of time. When your plunder will be divided among you, that means the nations are going to surround Jerusalem. They're going to come in and attack it. And this will be the final days of the 70th week. I will gather all nations. God will gather all nations to Jerusalem to fight against it, and they will be successful. The city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. Half the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. Something's going to intervene in that moment. Then the Lord... we would say Jesus. This is the Messiah, and it's capital letter, so it's Yahweh. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations that have gathered around Jerusalem as he fights in the day of battle. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. And again, I'll point out, especially as we read through the rest of these verses tonight, it's really hard not to understand this in any other way than literal, that Jesus is, or the Lord is going to be, on the Mount of Olives, that there's going to be water actually flowing, that we're actually talking about the light in the atmosphere, a change in the environment. There's actually going to be locations mentioned. And so there's only, you can try to allegorize this, make it a metaphor. Maybe he's talking about, you know, living water. It would be like spiritual water, the Holy Spirit. You can maybe squeeze a few of those things in there, but eventually you're going to run out of steam, and everything that is physically real in this verse, it's going to get real confusing if it's all got to become spiritual. So I'm just reading this literally. His feet will stand on the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem. Tells you where it's at. And the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west. And we talked about that. There's a 2.5 mile long mountain. Here is Jerusalem here, the Kidron Valley. It's going to be split in two from east to west, half the mountain moving north, half moving south. There's going to be a valley going out this way for the people to flee to the east into the wilderness. Will be split in two from east to west, forming a great valley. And again, it's not just going to be a crack. It's a valley for people to run, large amount of people to run, and eventually get to a place where they can hide. Half a mountain moving north, half a mountain moving south. You will flee by my mountain valley, the mountain valley that he creates, just like they parted the Red Sea so they could go across the Red Sea. This valley, they'll go through it. For it will extend to Azel. Now, again, we're not sure what Azel is. It appears to be a place to the east. Again, so we're waiting for that. No one is real sure what that would refer to. Again, this is being written, you know, 518, 520, so that's kind of their time frame. He's talking to those people, so it should make sense to them. You will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, around 750 B.C., king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. And again, the Lord is going to appear. This would be the second coming. This would be, the appearance of the Lord. Whatever it is, he's going to come. The holy ones, most likely the angels that accompany the Lord on his return. Again, the holy ones, they could be Christians, saints, believers. On that day, there will be no light. Now, this is the verses we're going to look at here tonight. On that day, there will be no light, no cold or frost. It will be a unique day without daytime or nighttime, a day known to the Lord. When evening comes, there will be light. Now, on your notes, we'll look at these notes here very quickly. Zechariah 14:6, in the English Standard Version on the notes, on that day, there shall be no light, cold or frost. The no light is typical of the day of the Lord. You got verses Joel and Amos, you know, the day of the Lord is darkness. Why are you looking forward to the day of the Lord? It's a day of dread and darkness. You've got references of the stars disappearing. But it's especially in the next verse, look at verse 14:7, and there shall be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time there shall be light. So what we're talking about here potentially is like twilight. It says there shall be no light, but it also says in that verse there shall be no cold or frost. Which, I mean, I don't know, I'm just going to try to explain it. If there's no light, say the sun just disappears, well, it's very cold and it freezes and we're like an ice ball floating in the universe. So he says there's no light, but no cold or frost. So in other words, there's no light, but that doesn't mean it's going to get cold, nor does it mean it's going to freeze. So there's no light. Well, what does that mean? It's not as bright as normal because in verse 7, it shall be a unique day, which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night. It's not going to be like daytime, you know, where the sun's out, but it's not nighttime where it's dark. Well, what is it? Well, but at evening time, there shall be light. It's going to be like the sun is setting. It's going to be dusk. And now all of a sudden, you got verses like the sun will have, it'll be like a sackcloth, or the moon will turn red. In other words, there's going to be something in the atmosphere. It's going to be, things are toned down. Whatever it is, it's going to be like dusk. There'll still be light. It won't be dark. It won't be bright. So that's setting up the stage right there. Because it says no cold or frost, because it's not, the temperature's not going to change. The water's not going to freeze. In fact, we're going to have water flowing here in a moment. So it's a unique day. It's going to be, in a sense, the stopping or the interruption of daytime. It's not day or night. It's going to interrupt the created sequence that began in Genesis. It's the creator that started it in Genesis is going to show up and just stop it. The sun's not rising. It's not, everything just stops. It's a unique day. Like, what's it like? It's a day known to the Lord. You can't compare it to anything. It's known to the Lord. That's just what it's going to be like. And then point two on chapter 14, verse 7, a unique day might be better understood and applied as a unique time period. It's not going to be a unique 24 hours. It's going to be a unique time period. So if we have our eschatological chart, and if you have a different eschatological chart than I do, you've got your 70th week right here, and then the Lord is returning towards the end, and then you're going to have a 1,000-year millennium. This is going to be, well, I write down here, it's after the 70th week, so it's after the Lord has returned, so it's after, but it's before the millennium begins. It's before here, because here, things will be up and running. It's after the 70th week. It's before the 1,000 years. It would be this restoration period, that time where Daniel talked about, you know, blessed if you make it to the certain, you got an extra 75 days right here. What is taking place? There may be judgments. There may be arrangements. This is that unique day, potentially, that they're talking about. Again, I'm teaching. I'm not saying this is what the Lord said to me. You see what the Lord said. It's right here in text. But it's a unique day. It doesn't seem to be part of the 70th week. It doesn't seem to be part of the millennium. It seems to be this time period right here, unique day known to the Lord. Now, chapter 14, verse 8, on that day, during this period, living water shall flow out from Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern sea and half of them to the western sea. It shall continue in the summer and in the winter. And so now we go back to some kind of a map here. You've got, I'll just draw a circle. You've got Jerusalem. You've got the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Mount of Olives has been split. You've got the northern half, the southern half, with a valley running this way. Water is going to flow out of Jerusalem. It says Jerusalem. Out of Jerusalem, part of the water is going to flow to the east, which is, if you go down the Kidron Valley, it eventually drains into the Dead Sea. This new valley right here will probably drain towards the Jordan into the Dead Sea. But half of it's going to go to the Western Sea, the Mediterranean Sea. And Jerusalem's high, and so you go from the high hills here, you go down to the foothills, and then into the plain and right into the Mediterranean Sea. So it's already laid out this way. But in Ezekiel, we could go there and read in Ezekiel, that water is coming out from the temple, but it's actually coming out from the throne that's sitting in the temple under the foot of the throne. Water, a little stream is flowing out, and the further it flows, Ezekiel finds he gets wider and wider. First it's ankle deep, then knee deep, thigh, then pretty soon he's able to swim in it. Then pretty soon it's so wide he can't cross it. And he comes back, and it seems to be this same river, and in Ezekiel it flows into the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea becomes alive, and fishermen are there fishing, throwing their nets in the Dead Sea, probably talking about, you know, the business and the fishing going on in the millennial kingdom. And if we were to press that, it fills up the Dead Sea. If you can see right here, the Dead Sea, it flows into the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea, it's the lowest place on earth, and the water doesn't drain anywhere, it just evaporates. So the water that flows there just evaporates and leaves behind all the minerals, and that's why it's called the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea, because everything's got a crust of salt on it. But in this case, it's flowing with fresh water. It's going to fill up with water, and it's going to flow out the bottom, and it will flow into down towards the Gulf of Aqaba there, into the Red Sea. And now Jerusalem is a seaport from the Mediterranean Sea all the way through here, from the Red Sea all the way up. It's now a seaport, like we said last night. We're going to get into next week on Monday night, when Jesus says, if you say to this mountain, be cast into the sea, it can be done. And Jesus says that while he's standing on the Mount of Olives, and it's going to become, if you push it, it's going to become a seaport. I'm tying things together. So that is what's being said there. On that day, living water shall flow out of Jerusalem. It doesn't say the temple, doesn't say the throne, but if we follow up in Ezekiel, it follows up like that. But it does say half of them to the eastern sea, that would be the Dead Sea, half of them to the western sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and it shall continue in summer as in winter. Once again, the days were interrupted during that period, that unique day. Now, summer and in winter. It doesn't say there's not going to be summer and winter, but summer, it becomes very dry. The wadi, say if you have like a valley, water in the winter times of the rain season will fill up and then flow through the wadis into the Dead Sea or off the mountain range down into the Mediterranean Sea. And so there's seasons where the water is flowing. But there's also seasons, and I've been there in the dry seasons, where you can walk in the wadis. You go down and walk all the way through them and look at the hill country of Judea or the wilderness of Judea. There have been times, just to say this, because all these wadis and these canals are connected, where you'll be down here, there's been tourists, it's never happened to me, but there's tourists down there and they're walking in the wadi, examining, and it had a huge rainstorm up north, and just, a ton of water. Well, it drains down into the wadis or the riverbeds, the dry riverbeds, and just you have like a flash flood, and there's been people just whoosh, swept away, never to be heard from again. They just get swept away in the water rushing down. And so that would be a summer situation where the wadis are dry. Then you think of a song from America, "I've been through the desert on a horse with no name, and it felt good to get out." Okay, that's exactly what they're talking about. I saw a riverbed that had gone dry. That's exactly what they're talking about. And then there was the joke, it's like, you've been on that horse for so you could have named the horse. All those days you're riding the horse, had time to name him. But nonetheless, okay, I digress. But winter and summer, in the summer it would be dry. In the winter, that would be the rainy season, or it's cold and things could even get cold or freeze. This is saying right here, on this time period, there shall be a water continuing to flow in the summer and the winter, which will change the whole environment of Israel, because you're not going to have a dry season. You may have summer, but you're going to have water flowing. You may have winter, but you're going to have water flowing the whole time. So it's going to change, and again, the earth is being reformed, set up for the millennial kingdom. So the Lord is coming by. As soon as he gets back, he starts making adjustments. He's not just defeating the armies, the nations are setting up his kingdom. He's also preparing the land for what he's going to be doing during his kingdom reign. So that's kind of what is being said there. And again, we have that amount of information. And then chapter 14, verse 9, "And the Lord will be king over the whole earth. On that day, the Lord will be one and his name one." Now, two things are here. I think you could break this apart. The Lord will be king over the whole earth. Now, he is going to be in Jerusalem on the throne, but he will be king over the whole earth like a political king. A political king. There will be nations on the earth, because we're going to mention those here in a moment. They'll be sending delegates, leadership, to worship and learn from the Lord and worship the Lord. So there will be nations, and these nations will have leaders. If you want to call them kings, you could call them kings. The Lord is going to be king of the whole world. The nations will have their own leadership, but they will be under the Lord. So he will be king of kings, but more like what we'd say an emperor, kind of like Cyrus. The Romans, King Herod was the king of the Jews, but he was appointed by Augustus. He worked for the Romans. So he was the king of this territory, and when he died, they tried to replace him with one of his sons. That didn't work out, and eventually they divided his territory up into four parts and gave two parts to two of his sons and some to some other individuals, and they were, in a sense, kings or leaders appointed by Rome. Rome was ruling. That was the emperor. That was Caesar. Jesus will be the emperor. He will be the Nebuchadnezzar. He will be the Caesar over these other nations. So that is one. The Lord will be king over the whole world. Again, I don't think we should think that I want to say a one world government. It is one leadership. He's overall, but he's definitely going to have nations that will be delegated. Leadership will be handed out to them. Now that's the first part. The Lord will be king over the whole earth. Now watch this. On that day, the Lord will be one and his name one. And that is going to be now, we'll just say God or deity. This is going to be spiritual. All the other spiritual powers, the rulers and authorities in the heavenly realms that You know, they're there today. People don't want to admit it. We're still in that secular humanism. We don't believe in that kind of stuff, except they're starting to dabble in it more and more. But you go back to the ancient world, they understood there were powers, the demonic powers. In this day, just like he's king of the whole world, physically, he is God of the whole planet. Satan will have passed, you know, not passed away, but Satan will have been locked up. The rulers and authorities will be eliminated, and he will be both the political leader and the spiritual leader. There will be no other God, no other temptation, no other name. He is the physical power and the spiritual power on the earth. And the Lord will be king over the whole earth on that day. On that day, the Lord will be one and his name one. And we got verses I wrote down there. I would love to read Psalm chapter 2. We've read it many times. David warns the nations, you kings of the earth, be warned. God's already appointed his son. His son is going to be the king, and the nations bow down. And if you make him angry, his anger can flare up in a moment and dash you to pieces. That is him ruling at this time with an iron scepter. We can think of Jesus as being, you know, the kind healer that goes around the crowd. But this, when he comes back, he's going to be ruling with an iron scepter. Now, we saw that last night where Bartimaeus called him son of David, asking for mercy, because he will be the king ruling politically, but he'll also be then distributing justice and mercy throughout the world because of his position. So you can see him as being the merciful king, but at the same time, he is also going to be ruling with an iron scepter. It's going to be his way or the highway, or in this case, his way or no way. He'll be the only name. It's not like, well, we're going to vote on this. That's not what everybody thinks. No, you can't have an opinion. You're going to do it this way. Now, he's going to be gracious and merciful, but he is the truth. He is the way. He is the light. He knows what he created. He knows how he wants to do it. And he gave mankind plenty of time. We're dabbling in it right now, having our own ideas, having our own opinions, choosing our own genders, all this kind of thing. It's like, okay, we're done with this. I'm now going to show you how to do it. And when he does, we're going to see the nations will stream to Jerusalem to hear him explain things. Okay, we continue. Well, I got verses written down at the bottom of page 1, Daniel 2:44. In those days, those kings, the God of the heaven, will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. Daniel chapter 7, verse 27, and the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. That might be part of us ruling and reigning. And that's, again, I haven't figured that whole thing out, because there's going to be physical people on the earth. There's going to be resurrected saints ruling with Christ. And where is their placement going to be? Are they going to be in Jerusalem with him? Are they the ones ruling over the nations? It doesn't seem like it, because some of those nations rebel against him. It doesn't seem like a resurrected saint who's ruling their territory will, like, halfway through the millennium go, you know, I've had enough of this. I'm going to be God for a while. And that doesn't seem to make sense. It seems like it'd be natural people who still have that seed of Adam within them that will rebel. Because there will be, at the end of the millennium, there will be an enormous rebellion when Satan is released, which, again, boggles your mind. But they will have had enough of the iron scepter. And just like you can see people today, and you see them today, how dumb can they be? I mean, you're trying to rewrite reality. I mean, science has proven, we've known this, everybody's known this for ages. And all of a sudden, you've decided you're going to rewrite reality? It's like, and some of us look and say, that's ridiculous. And Jesus isn't even here, but yet his reality is here speaking truth. And they're changing it, they think. Well, something similar will happen at the end of the millennium, where after 1,000 years, they'll think, or, you know, if it's at the 700-year mark, 800-year mark, wherever they decide, there's going to be an enormous rebellion when Satan is released. They're waiting for another chance to rewrite reality into their own image. And again, they get destroyed with fire coming out of heaven, and that's at the end of Revelation. But again, point D on top of page 2, this is interesting, and you don't always think about this, the Lord's Prayer. Jesus, the disciples ask, teach us to pray. Jesus says, pray like this. And the first thing they're praying is eschatology. It's like, what? Well, here, it says, pray like this. Our Father in heaven, you pray to our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. And then he says, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. What is that? That is praying for your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as you're doing it in heaven. We want that on earth, and we're waiting for it. I mean, our prayer begins, the Lord's prayer begins after recognizing God as the Father and his name being hallowed, meaning holy, blessed, is to pray that his kingdom come on earth. So you wonder how to pray? It's like, we want your will done right here. We want your kingdom to come. And Jesus, that's the first thing he taught his disciples to pray, is your kingdom come. So the Lord's Prayer is, it begins eschatologically. Okay, chapter 14, verse 10. Now, with the parting of the Mount of Olives, and we can see this throughout this, when the Lord returns, and these things keep being repeated, you know, the lights, you know, the storms, the appearance, the battles. Well, now here's something else. There's going to be an earthquake, which probably is part of the separating of the Mount of Olives. But because of that, chapter 14, verse 10, and this is just in Zechariah, but you can see it throughout Scripture, the whole land, talking about Israel, with Jerusalem being the center, shall be turned into a plain. It's going to go flat. Now, if we look at the Kidron Valley, in fact, I wish we would have, I would have put a map in here. Here's the Kidron Valley, and you're going to have Mount Moriah rising up like this. It goes up higher and higher. This is higher in the north up here than it is down here in the city of David, and the temple's right here, and the mound continues to rise. On the other side of the Kidron Valley is the Mount of Olives. There's another valley, comes down here and joins over here, which would be the Hinnom Valley. Then there's going to be a western hill over here, and it rises over here. There's hills. And then this whole area is just hills and mountains and rocks. And again, we're talking about not snow-capped mountains, but high place. You got to go down, come up. This whole place is going to become a plain. It's all going to go flat. The whole land shall be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. Now, Geba, I'll show you in a map here in just a moment, is up here about 6 miles north, and I'll point some things out about that. That's the high place. You can stand there and look down on Jerusalem. And then to the southwest, about 35 miles, is Rimmon. So from this, which is a higher place even today, not like crazy high, but you can stand there and look down on Jerusalem, it's going to go flat. All these hills, the Kidron Valley, of course, or the Mount of Olives already been split in two. That's going to go flat. This whole area is going to go flat all the way down to Rimmon, 35 miles south. But Jerusalem shall remain aloft on its site. And now we're going to read about this here. From the gate of Benjamin to the place of the former gate to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hanel to the king's winepress, Jerusalem is going to be lifted up. Now, this is repeated throughout the Scriptures. If you look at Isaiah, I've got it written down here for you, Isaiah 2:2, which is exactly the same thing Micah says in Micah 4:1. It says, it shall come to pass in the latter days, and that's an eschatological reference, in the end times, that the mountain of the house of the Lord, that is Mount Moriah, the mountain of the house of the Lord, that is this right here, that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. Now, many things are being said there. First of all, it backs up the idea, this is going to become a plain, this is going to be lifted up. But then it also says, as the highest of the mountains. If you remember, when Jesus returns, the Lord returns, if it be at the end of Revelation, anytime, there's always an earthquakes, there's storms, the islands vanish, the mountains collapse. That's what's taking place. The topography of the earth is being changed. And this goes kind of when we talk about the days of Noah before the flood, the days after the flood. Our world today, people, we're locked in. You can't even think. I mean, we can't even think because the mountains are millions of years old, the rivers have worn away this. And when you look at it in another way, in the flood of Noah, it says the fountains of the deep, or the fountains of the deep burst forth, and the continental plates moved and mountains were formed. And they'd say, well, there's not enough water could cover all the mountains. They'd say, well, that couldn't even happen. It's like, remember, those mountains may not have been there before the flood. It was such a catastrophic event that the earth broke open, water came up out, and continental plates moved. They crashed, they buckled, and mountains were formed not in millions of years, but in moments. And sediments were laid down in moments. Like they talk about, you know, they've taken, again, I don't want to get too far into this because it's, I don't have the notes, but they've taken, you know, students out to like the Grand Canyon, and you know, they date this, how old is this, and with all their knowledge they date it to millions of years or whatever, and then they take them to Mount St. Helen. Now you remember Mount St. Helen, we watched it on video. It's a mountain, and then it blew up, half the mountain blew off, and they go out there and just blew it off, and there's all kinds of, you've got in real time a videotape of a microcosm of Noah's flood in a sense. And they come back now, what is it, 30 years later? How many years was it? Early 80s, wasn't it? And we remember it. And now they do it. They date that. Oh, yeah, this matches the Grand Canyon. This is also millions of years. No. Watch the video. This happened in 24 hours. This happened in 32 hours. It just laid down a sediment here, one after another. Water rushed through. And now it's become like this stone in a matter of 30 years. It's like, well, that changes things. Yeah, so now go back and now date this with the videotape and take that model and lay it on the Grand Canyon. It's like, oh, well, this might have happened in, you know, 2-3 days of just, boom, water rushing out, being caught up in some kind of a lake, you know, big ocean-like area in North America, and just rushing out and carve the Grand Canyon. All kinds of things like that happen suddenly. With that being said, that's what's going to take place here. Greater than the flood of Noah is the return of the Lord into, not coming in a manger, but coming out of heaven as the glorious resurrected Lord and coming into the atmosphere. Look what happened on Mount Sinai when the Lord came down and just spoke on Mount Sinai. Here he's going to come down and join humanity, not as a baby in the manger, but as the resurrected Lord who is God. And of course, there's going to be topographical changes. And so, that's what it says right here. Isaiah 2, Micah 4, and it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains. One reason, because all in Revelation and other prophecies in the Old Testament, the mountains are going to collapse and the islands are going to disappear. And so, even if Jerusalem isn't lifted up, which it says it will be the highest one left because it's not going to collapse. Everything else is going to collapse except Jerusalem. But Jerusalem, we go to Ezekiel 40, just jumping in the middle of this. This is the beginning of the vision of Ezekiel when he goes through the temple, the temple that's going to be built after this event, at the temple that's going to be built on this city. The temple that is in the millennium, of course, is not the rebuilt temple that the Antichrist will eventually occupy. That temple will be replaced with this millennial temple that Ezekiel begins to see in chapter 40. Ezekiel 40, verse 2 through 3, in visions of God, he brought me to the land of Israel. Now, Ezekiel is in Babylon. He's over there in Babylon, and he's brought in a vision back to Jerusalem to see this. And set me down on a, he just says, here's what he says, and set me down on a very high mountain on which was a structure like a city to the south. It's a very high mountain with a city to the south. When he brought me there, behold, there was a man whose appearance was like bronze with a linen cord and a measuring, the linen cord and a measuring reed. Those are basically, a linen cord is a large tape measure. It's a, like you've got like little tape measure that stretch out 25 feet. This linen cord would be one of those 100-foot tape measures that you measure like the discus or the shot put or something with. And it, you wrap it up, it's like it stretches out 100 feet or whatever. That's what is, he says, who had a linen cord, that's a tape measure, and a measuring reed, that's a yardstick. So here's an angel, a bronze type, you know, looked like bronze, and he's got in one hand a tape measure, and in the other hand a yardstick. And he was standing in the gateway. The gateway of what? If we continue reading, he's standing in the gateway of the temple on the mountain with the city to the south. He's standing there with a tape measure and a measuring rod, a tape measure and a yardstick, and it's like, what's going to happen? I'm going to show you the temple. And he starts measuring stuff for Ezekiel. Ezekiel's like taking notes. And he writes the next few chapters is the whole temple. In fact, some of your study Bibles will have this temple drawn in it because there's enough detail in chapter 41, 42, 43 that you can draw out the temple where everything's at. It's so detailed. And that is right here. And where is it at? It's on a very high mountain with a city to the south. It's Jerusalem of the millennium with the temple that's very high. And we know from earlier or later coming up in those chapters and from Zechariah, water is going to be flowing out from that temple mount from the top of that mountain to the two seas, giving life to everything. And so that's the that's Jerusalem being lifted up. And now, if you don't mind, Revelation 16, 17 through 21, somehow this would fit together because this is the Lord returning. This is the seventh bowl. Again, these things overlap. But you got this amount, what do you call those Venn diagrams or something where you've got a circle? Okay, here you got this circle here. Is this a Venn diagram? You got a circle there. Then you've got a circle here. And then you've got a circle here. This would be Zechariah. This would be Ezekiel. And this would be Revelation. So Revelation is going to be saying some things down here. It's like, wait a minute, Zechariah didn't say that. No, but Revelation says this information that overlaps with Zechariah. We're going to be talking about an earthquake. We're going to be talking about the city. We're going to be talking about these events. Ezekiel's talking about certain events, but he's overlapping here. Zechariah's talking about the last battle, and he's overlapping here. So these are the things that you're going to see in Zechariah, Ezekiel, and Revelation. And don't let these things that are in their own circles, well, that doesn't say that in Ezekiel, because he's not talking about this. He's talking about this, and it overlaps Revelation right there, if that makes sense. So here it is. This is the seventh bowl, which is the seals, the trumpets, the seven bowls, and the seventh bowl is the last. So this is the end. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne. This is the heavenly temple. The throne saying, it is done. And there were flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a great earthquake. Now that great earthquake is going to flatten the mountains and then the islands. That great earthquake is going to split the Mount of Olives. That great earthquake is going to raise up Jerusalem. An earthquake such that there had never been since man was on the earth. Now do you understand what that means? In light of Noah's flood, the fountains of the deep burst forth, the continental plates opened up, and water came out and flooded. It was you talk about a tsunami. I mean, we could go through more details of that. But the water burst forth, possibly goes up in the atmosphere, freezes and comes down and buries things in ice because it froze as it went up, and the whole earth is covered with water. That's a serious earthquake. This is an earthquake at this time after the seventh bowl when the Lord begins to return. Man's never seen anything like this. And man has seen Noah's flood. And so it's like it dwarfs that, according to the scriptures. So great was the earthquake. The great city was split into three parts. Now, this would appear to be Jerusalem is split into three parts. Mountains already been split. And the cities of the nations fell. So Jerusalem is split into three parts. All the other cities of the world collapse. And it says, and God remembered Babylon the Great, which is another city somewhere else. Again, I'm still wondering where that, if it's going to be actual, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to call anybody a heretic. I don't want anybody to call me a heretic. Is Babylon actually going to be rebuilt? It's hard to imagine. But it's very hard for Martin Luther to imagine Israel being in the land of Israel again. And here they are, and we're used to it. So I can't imagine in the wilderness, the desert, go over to Babylon and be rebuilt. It's like there's nothing here. But maybe it's that new New Ulm, is that what you in Saudi Arabia? Maybe it's some city. Maybe it's Rome. Maybe it's New York. I don't think so. Maybe it's Jerusalem. All these things are out there discussed. I've got some ideas I like better. I used to like the rebuilding of Babylon, but it seems so far fetched. But Martin Luther again thought, you know, far-fetched for the Jews to be back in the land. So we can only talk about it from our perspective. Anyway, God remember Babylon the Great to make her drain the cup of wine and the fury of his wrath, and every island fled away, and no mountains could be found because they all collapsed. And great hailstones, about 100 pounds each, fell from heaven on people. Now notice there's still people running around the earth. They haven't come under, God has not set up the judgment of the survivors yet. And they're running around getting hit by 100-pound hailstones. And of course, you know, you start getting hit by 100-pound hailstones, I'm not going to say you would, but you understand, and they curse God for the plague of hail because the plague was so severe. I mean, their cities are ruined. They're running around and they can't go everywhere they go. It's like, well, we just go into a basement. Well, the basements have all collapsed. Things are falling in. There's nowhere to go. And just getting bombarded with 100-pound hailstones. I mean, you can see why they're upset. It's like a terrible movie. Or a good movie. Depends on what you're watching. Okay. Point three, literally describing the physical appearance of Jerusalem. This would be confusing. I already said this. This would be confusing to spiritualize all of this to have it mean some hidden meaning. Now, the plain from Geba to Rimmon, and you see right here on a little map, I made this map probably in 1987, okay? 87, 88. I just scanned it and put it online. And there you can see the Mount of Olives is split, you see? And you can see water flowing into the Dead Sea. But you see right to the north there, it says Geba, G-E-B-A. That's about 6 miles north of Jerusalem. Even today, it comes from the word that means hill. And then you can see Rimmon about southwest, about 35 miles southwest. So from Geba to the north down to En Rimmon, that whole thing goes flat. And Jerusalem is the center of it like a mountain. Again, now when we say mountain, you know, this is today is called, well, I don't even have it on the map anymore. We call it Mount Moriah, but it's just a hill. We would call it, you know, like I live in Western Hills. It'd be like Western Mountain. I mean, it's kind of like that. It's not like you need a rope to climb up. So keep that in mind when they start talking about these things. So you can see where Geba is and Rimmon. And then turn the page. And now there's a close-up of the territory there. You can see Bethlehem is 2 miles south of Jerusalem. Geba is about 6 miles north of Jerusalem. Again, not that my map is exact. But Geba right there, I wish I would have gave you another picture. I've got them online. But I am standing, when I took this picture, I'm standing north of Jerusalem at that place called Gibeah. You see, G-I-B-E-A-H. I'm standing at Gibeah, or the high place of Gibeon. That's where Solomon offered the bulls when the Lord came to him. There's no temple, and that's probably where they kept the Ark of the Covenant. It was a makeshift tabernacle until the tent, because it had been burnt down by the Philistines before Solomon. And that's where the Lord appeared to him on that very high place. Samuel's burial is there, if it's actually the place or not. It's called Nabi Samuel. And if you turn around from where I'm looking to the north right there, if I turn around and look this way, I can look down at Jerusalem. And even you can see the Mount of Olives. But you can see right there, there's some high place there, the high place of Gibeon. And I write in that box, Gibeah and Geba are the names of the same city in the territory of Benjamin. See, by this time, we're just a few miles outside of Jerusalem, but you're already in the territory of Benjamin. There are several place names there with the Hebrew G-B. Now, there's no vowels. There's just the consonants. G-B, which means hill. And so that's where you get the names like Gibeon, Geba, Gibeah, Gibeath. And all of them are, in a sense, the same location right here. And so there you can see that right there. So that is the place. That's an actual place that's going to go flat. And it's higher than Jerusalem today, all the way down. Then it continues to talk about the point four, the gate of Benjamin to the place of the former gate, to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hanel to the king's winepress. And now what we're doing is we're talking about, here's the Temple Mount. And again, this is Zechariah writing in 518, somewhere in that time period. And so some of these things are going to be familiar. You're going to have a city going up like this. In fact, at the bottom of page 3, I've got the city of Jerusalem in Nehemiah's day, 433. So this is about 90 years later, and we'll talk about this when we get after Ezra. We'll go to Nehemiah. But the first place right there, it will go flat, and this will be part of the city right here. The gate of Benjamin will have to be on the north. So somewhere up here is the gate of Benjamin, similar to the Damascus gate today. It's on the north side of the city. Point B, the former gate or the first gate would be the old gate. And we're not sure where that would be. Maybe it's a gate over here that's the remains are there, but it wasn't functioning. So we don't know where that's at for sure. The corner gate is mentioned in Jeremiah 31:38, would probably be over in this corner right here. And that was in existence, the northwest corner, the corner gate. The Tower of Hananel, and the Tower of Hananel was over in this area right here as a tower. It was eventually incorporated into Fort Antonia, where Herod built, and it disappeared into that place there. And then it mentions the king's wine press, and this is where, if south down here where the Gihon Springs, this is the Kidron Valley, the springs of the city were right here. David's palace was right above that. That's where the royal palace was. And right down here in the Kidron Valley was a very well-watered garden. It's where the king's garden was. It's where the king's pool was. And now it says the king's wine press, because there was a lot of vegetation down in here. And there's canals for the water to run out of the Gihon Springs to water this area. This is a beautiful area right here. This is where the kings were anointed. So it describes from here all the way around to here, it describes, that's what it's referring to in those verses. I'll read it again now in the text. The whole land shall be turned into a plain from Geba to the north, the Rimmon in the south, but Jerusalem shall remain aloft. It's going to be lifted up from the site of the Benjamin Gate, from here over to here, all the way around here. It's going to be lifted up. Remember, Ezekiel sees that city to the south of the Temple Mount, on the side of the mountain. But Jerusalem shall remain aloft on its site from the gate of Benjamin to the place of the former gate, to the corner gate, probably on the northwest side, and from the Tower of Hananel to the king's wine press. And I've got references there of it being lifted up like that. Okay, turn the page. We're on page 3, and I got all those gates. And now, to finish this up, this is what we've looked at this before, and a lot of this is just self-explanatory. And the important thing about this is when we start taking Revelation and Ezekiel and Zechariah and all the prophecies, putting them together, remember these things that are being said because they overlap with those other prophecies and add to them in some cases. And it shall be inhabited, this city that is lifted up and there's a plain around it, it shall be lifted, it shall be inhabited during the millennium. For there shall never again be a decree of utter destruction. Never again will it be destroyed. Now, at the end of the millennium, Satan's going to be released, and the nations are going to march on Jerusalem. But if you read the text, fire consumes them out of heaven, and they're gone. They come, but nothing happens. And that will be a fulfillment of this. Jerusalem shall dwell in security from that day on. And now we go back. We've already talked about these verses. Going back now to the Lord returning in the future, this will be the plague that happens to the enemies. And anytime you see the Lord coming back, if it's Revelation 19, if it's Matthew 24, some prophecy, this will have to fit into that. And this shall be the plague with which the Lord shall strike all the peoples that wage war against Jerusalem on that day, the nations. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet, their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. Now this is right after the seventh bowl has been poured out, when the earthquake is shaking, and the mountains are splitting, and the mountains are falling, hailstones are coming. Now, hailstones are falling around the earth, apparently. This battle is taking place in Jerusalem. It's not everybody in the earth rots, it's the armies of the nations that have invaded Jerusalem. They start to melt and are destroyed. Chapter 14, verse 13, and on that day a great panic from the Lord shall fall on them. obviously, so that each will seize the hand of another, and the hand of one will be raised against the hand of another. So these nations that have come together against Jerusalem will turn on each other. We saw that in the Old Testament on different occasions. Confusion in the ranks, and they start killing each other. Jews are just watching. But going back to chapter 12, when you see the Jews fighting alongside the Lord against the nations and taking their plunder, we return to that theme here. Even Judah will fight at Jerusalem. So on that day, there will be Jews that have endured the 70th week in Jerusalem from the tribe of Judah fighting amongst this chaos. And we saw that in detail in chapter 12. Even Judah will fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be collected, gold, silver, and garments in great abundance. After the war, they'll go out and gather all this plunder and bring it in. Kind of like when they leave Egypt, they plundered Egypt. Egypt gave them gold, gave them things to go, valuables to leave. The same thing will happen here. Verse 15, and a plague like this plague shall fall on the horses, the mules, the camels, the donkeys, and whatever beast may be in those camps. Once again, I say this sounds like the Roman invasion when they used donkeys to bring all, because when they invade Jerusalem, and the Romans did in 66 AD, they had to get firewood, they had to get siege material to build the siege engines. And they were going 20 miles away to get lumber, timber, to build the siege works. So, I mean, they had to have engineers building. They just didn't have soldiers out there, shooting arrows. They had engineers building structures to attack the city. But the engineers needed material, and the material just kept getting further and further away as they cut down trees. Eventually, they were going 20 miles away to get lumber. Now they got a lumber company, a shipping company, engineers building siege works so the soldiers can run up and attack the wall. That's the Roman military. Now we're not even talking about food. And then they go through and talks about how much, when you go through and read a history book, talks about how much food the men needed, both, some kind of bread and some kind of, vegetables or meat or something. And they're transporting all this with donkeys and horses. Well, they've got to eat something. So now you've got to have grain and fodder for the animals and water for all these people. So you've got an entire, Hy-Vee shipping going on here trying to get food to all these people. And so this sounds just like the Roman. We talk about their horses and mules and camels. That's all their supply lines. But again, is that allegorical? Does that mean trucks, ships, helicopters dropping off, supplies? Or is this taking place in the future far enough away from our technology that we've all gone back to the Dark Ages, which I guarantee we are heading towards with our stupid science of today? It's no longer science. It's now propaganda. And you add another 5, 10, 20 years to the direction we're going, we are in the Dark Ages, medically, academically, historically. I mean, we won't even remember history. History will be... Because how would they forget this? You're seeing before your very eyes how people forget history. They erase it. They flush it down the toilet. They change it. They reteach it in their own image. And it's like, what about all this technology? Eventually, because you're going to make the people so stupid and ignorant, they cannot maintain the technology that developed. Like, we've all got smartphones, but once you get to the place where you don't have the trucking, you don't have the product, you don't have the workforce, everything goes out of date, and you're right back to, writing notes on some kind of corn husk and giving it to a pigeon to fly across the country and drop it on. Oh, look, I got a pigeon that can bring messages. Wow. And then people someday make fun of that, not realize that you once had a cell phone. I'm not saying the ancient world had cell phones, but I am saying that we've got cell phones today, and someday we're going to be communicating on something far less than a telephone or a telegraph. Nonetheless, that may be why there's horses, mules, and camels. Again, this is all literal, I think. Why all of a sudden are they going to be saying horses and mules, but we really mean trucks? I mean, maybe that's what they're doing. They're speaking the language of their day. But I'm suggesting, at least, and again, I don't know. It's like this could happen. They're fighting with swords and arrows and riding on a horse and transporting supplies with mules. Anyway, they all have the same plague, then they all rot. Chapter 14, verse 16, then everyone who survives. Now, obviously, if you're in that battle that day, you don't survive. Your tongue rots. I mean, your body rots. And your neighbors, if you're still struggling, they stab you and kill you, the nations you're fighting with. So they're all dead. This would tie into blood flowing up to the horse's bridle. Where'd all that blood come from? Well, we just dissolved all the militaries of the nations. We just rotted them, and they're just flowing away. I mean, it's like, where'd all that blood come from? That's it. And the distance it flows, my friends, would be the distance from Jerusalem, if it were to flow down the wadis, down the Kidron Valley, into the Dead Sea, out the bottom of the Dead Sea, and all the way to the Gulf of Aquaba. That is the same distance. When it talks about, what was it, 1,400 or some stadii, or how many miles, that is the distance. Especially if you have wadis and there's a little bit of turning going on, it flows from Jerusalem into the Red Sea. Now, when it says the blood flows, it's not like the whole nation is swimming in blood. Just like water, it's going to go from the high place and rush down into the low place and flow out. When it gets that low place into the wadis, you're going to have blood flowing as high as a horse's bridle out through the Dead Sea down into the Red Sea. It doesn't give you a map in the Bible. I'm just suggesting that because if water flows from Jerusalem into the Dead Sea, it's going to flow into the Red Sea. That we know that. Well, which way is the blood going to flow? Uphill? I mean, it's going to flow the same way. So that plague and everything rotting would match the blood flowing up to the horse's bridle. But verse 16, then everyone who survives of all the nations, who survives of all the nations? Everybody that's back home. Now, they're getting hit by hailstones and they've got their own problems, but they survive. Some of them are believers. Some of them are not. They're about to face the sheep and goat judgment in the Kidron Valley with the Lord. Anyway, those who survive the tribulation, this devastation, and the sheep and goat judgment, they're welcome into the kingdom. They shall, it says, those who survive of all the nations that have come against Jerusalem. Now, their home countries went against Jerusalem, but they themselves were believers, and they survived the judgment. They survived the plagues. They will come up. Go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts. There will be no rain on. Okay, excuse me. Then everyone who survives, I mean, chapter 14, verse 16. Then everyone who survives of all the nations that have come against Jerusalem shall go up year after year. Now we're talking definitely outside of a 24-hour day because we're talking year after year what's going to be going on through the millennium to worship the King, the Lord of hosts. And you can see right there, potentially, the political king, God, the Lord of hosts. So he's the man who's ruling, but he's God. He's the king, he's God. To keep the Feast of Booths. The Feast of Booths remembers when the Lord put them in and they had to dwell in shelters in the wilderness, but it also recognized that God was dwelling with them. The Feast of Booths recognizes two things. They had to make makeshift shelters in the wilderness for 40 years, but they were in the wilderness where the Lord was dwelling with them in the tabernacle. And so when they celebrate the Feast of Booths, they're celebrating the Lord dwelling with them. And so of all the feasts, they don't have to come up for, again, this is what the text says. It doesn't say they come up for Passover. The Jews remember Passover, not all the nations. What the nations will remember is the Lord is dwelling with us. The Lord is in Jerusalem, and they come up every year to recognize and worship him because he is just like he dwelt with Israel in the wilderness, he's now dwelling with us in history, in time, in our world. And so that's why it's the Feast of Booths. Now, it doesn't say they're not going to celebrate other feasts. Ezekiel goes into all the more details there. But they will come up, and they are celebrating the fact that the Lord is dwelling with them. Now, chapter 14, verse 17, and if any of the families of the earth, the peoples of the earth, do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King. Now, why would they not? At first, they probably will, but eventually, It's going to set in. It's like we're tired of being told what to do. We've got our own ideas. Why don't we try it this way? Has anybody ever thought there might be more than two genders? I think there might be more. It's like give them 500, 600, 700 years and they'll be just as stupid as we are. And they say, we're not going to go up there. It would be better if he wasn't here. It would be better if we had our own plan. Okay. And if any of the families of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. Meaning he's got plenty of water in Jerusalem. He's taking care of the whole earth. Everything's beautiful. Everything's pleasant. Just follow my directions and enjoy life. Well, we've decided to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and we've got our own thoughts. Well, you're not getting any rain. Try that. Try to get your own rain. Make your own water. And, of course, they can't. And then he gives another example. And if the family of Egypt, for example, the nation of Egypt, does not go up and present themselves, then on them there shall be no rain. There shall be the plague with which the Lord afflicts the nations that do not go up to keep the feast of booths. So they're going to get no rain. We don't know what this plague is. I don't know if it's the exact same plague where their flesh rots, you know, their tongue rots, or it's just some kind of a disease that breaks out. He will send them no rain, and here's the disease. Maybe it's COVID. I don't know. Maybe it's, you know, Jesus' own form of COVID he'll send on them. I mean, listen, there's no Satan here sending the plagues. It's Jesus sending the plagues, just like in the Exodus. And he'll afflict the nations with this particular plague if they do not present themselves for the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths. Chapter 14, verse 19, this shall be the punishment to Egypt and the punishment to all the nations that do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths. And that is, that's three times, three verses there that mention the plague and four verses talking about the Feast of Booths. So right there you got four verses talking about the Feast of Tabernacles, saying everyone's going to come up, and then three of those four verses saying, listen, you don't really have a choice. I'm going to send a plague. I'm going to send you no water. Chapter 14, verse 20, and on that day there shall be inscribed on the bells of the horses, holy to the Lord. Now, holy to the Lord, holy means set apart. It doesn't mean it's morally upright. It doesn't mean it's got some kind of special magic. It means it has been set apart for the Lord. In other words, these last few verses, the point is everything is set apart for the Lord. So if everything is set apart for the Lord and you're going to use something, you're going to have to use something that's set apart for the Lord. Everything is set apart. Well, I've got my own phone. Wait a minute. That's a holy phone. That's been set apart for the Lord. Well, what phone do I use? There's only the holy phone. There's only everything's been set apart for the Lord. Now, again, holy not meaning morally righteous. It means it is set apart for the Lord's purpose. And here it is. And on that day there shall be inscribed on the bells of the horses, holy to the Lord. And the pots in the house of the Lord shall be as the bowls before the altar. And every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holy to the Lord of hosts, so that all who sacrifice may come and take of them and boil the meat of the sacrifice in them, and there shall no longer be a traitor in the house of the Lord of the hosts on that day. That word traitor is the word Canaanite. And they figure that's a merchant, like Jesus cleared the merchants out. They're up there, and they were using the temple that was set apart holy to the Lord to make a little money on the side. So they were using what was holy to the Lord to make a little thing set apart for me. In other words, in those days, no one will be setting apart something for themselves. Everything is holy to the Lord. There'll be no Canaanite there saying, okay, we'll make a little deal. This is holy to the Lord, but I'll take a little bit off the top for myself. It's like, you can't. It's all the Lord's. It's like, will people even pay a tithe? I mean, it's like you just give, it's all the Lord's. I mean, Ezekiel answers that question. So in other words, the fact that everything from the bells to the bowls, everything is set apart for the Lord or holy to the Lord, and there's no longer a traitor in the household, there's no sense being here because you get what you get. He's given you what you got. It's all his. He's gave it to you. So there's really, in a sense, no lack. And so if you start trying to trade and get something, what are you trying to get? I mean, you've got everything you need. Well, I'm trying to get a little extra here for myself. God has given you all you need. Everything is here. And that's how the book of Zechariah ends. There's no traders, there's no merchants, and that is the book of Zechariah. And the vision Zechariah closes with, and because of Haggai and Zechariah, very quickly, I was looking at the clock, very quickly go to Ezra. Ezra, again, this is, you're thinking this is ridiculous, you shouldn't do this. But I'm in Ezra chapter 4, verse 24. And you can see right there the letter that you've got that is being read, and it's the Samaritans brought it back. Chapter 4, verse 24, verse 23, as soon as a copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them to stop. You can't do this. You can't build the temple. This is 536 up in here. Then the work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia, 520. So right here, it stopped here in 536. Cyrus finished his career. Cambyses came and left. There's a little insurrection. Darius came, and in 520, what takes place? Well, Darius shows up in the Persian Empire, but more importantly, chapter 5, verse 1, now Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the prophet, a descendant of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua the priest, son of Jehozadak, set to work to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. So they stopped until those two guys we just studied over the last year, they came, and all of a sudden Israel takes a 180 and they start building the temple of God. And they're going to be done in a matter of, you know, if it's 520, they'll be done in 4 years. 48 months, they're done. They're finished. So we'll go back to Ezra next week and continue. I'll pray and we're done. I appreciate you being here. Father, we do thank you for the word of God. We thank you for the chance to look into these things. We ask that we may do our part at this time in history to understand your word, to live a life that is pleasing to you, and to help prepare others for your coming kingdom. We do, again, thank you for your spirit. We thank you for Jesus Christ, and we thank you for fellowship with other believers. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.